open and remove the 10.5-inch barreled upper receiver from the weapon's lower. He then retrieved a second upper from the Pelican case and attached it to the same lower receiver. The second upper wore a longer 14.5-inch barrel with a 40-millimeter grenade launcher attached underneath. A Trijicon ACOG sight was mounted to its top, along with another ATPL laser aiming device. He removed the Knight's armament suppressor from the shorter upper and placed it on the longer barrel before confirming that both the ACOG and the laser were zeroed correctly. He reassembled the rifle with the short barrel and suppressor and placed everything back into the case. The last weapon was one that, as an officer, he hadn't used in quite some time. The Mark 48 Mod 1 was a compact belt-fed light machine gun that basically served as an improved version of the old Vietnam-era M60. Like his far more compact assault rifle, the Mark 48 that he'd checked out of the armory was painted camouflage and fitted with both a laser-aiming device and an EOTech sight. Reese set the weapon down on its bipod and lifted the feed cover. He placed a 5-round belt of 7.62x51mm ammunition into the top of the feed tray, closed the cover, and pulled the bolt to the rear, where it locked into place. True machine guns fire from an open bolt position. Unlike the rifles, which he controlled with minimal muscle tension, he bore down hard on the Mark 48 to control the weapon. Reese found the box in the sight and pressed the trigger, which fired 2 rounds before he could release it. He reacquired the target and fired the remainder of the belt. The binoculars showed at least 4 30-caliber holes in the target, in addition to the one he'd fired from his Legend. As far as he was concerned, that was damn good for a belt-fed machine gun. He repacked all of his gear into the back of the cruiser and concealed the weapons cases and ammo cans under the blanket before stacking his luggage on top. His business concluded, he climbed back into the driver's seat and made his way back to the interstate. Flagstaff, Arizona. As Reese headed east and then north, he steered toward Flagstaff, where he had one last important stop to make. He pulled into the Mount Eldon Assisted Living and Nursing Center and walked through the main entrance. He asked for directions to Judy Reese's room and signed himself in as Jim Watson before heading down the hallway. When he opened the door to the small but immaculately kept room, he saw his mother sitting upright in a recliner. She wore a white sweater and khaki pants, hair perfectly coiffed and her makeup a bit smeared. Despite her condition, and with the help of the understanding staff, she'd maintained her outward dignity as a Southern lady. She seemed to take no notice of him as he walked in the door and shut it behind him. He gave her a hug and a kiss on the cheek, taking a seat on the couch directly across from her. He'd been in high school when she had her first stroke, and though she recovered physically, she was never the same again. Her dad used to joke lovingly, "She didn't play the piano before and isn't going to start playing now." Not surprisingly, she began showing signs of dementia in her late 60s, and after his father's death, she went downhill quickly. It took every dime that his father had left behind to put her in a place that would take good care of her, and she had quickly become a staff favorite. Reese made it to Flagstaff as often as he could, though never as often as he intended, sitting with his mother and reading to her from her favorite books. In reality, much of the mother he knew was already gone. Still, he had to say goodbye to what was left. His mother rarely spoke these days, and when she did, it never made much sense. On a good day, she would ask you what time it was every 30 seconds. She seemed to listen, though, and she stared past Reese toward the window as he told her the whole story. If she were lucid, he would have spared her the pain of knowing that her beloved daughter-in-law and only granddaughter had been slain in their home, guilty only by association. Under the circumstances, he was pretty sure that she didn't understand, and he needed to get it off his chest. Growing up, he could always tell his mother anything. When he finished telling her of the tragic events that had transformed his life, her face remained unchanged. Then, without breaking her gaze from the window, she spoke softly, but clearly.
"And judges, Gideon asks God how to choose his men for battle. The Lord told Gideon to take his men down to the river and drink. The men who flopped down on their bellies and drank like dogs were no good to him. Gideon watched as some of his men knelt down and drank with their heads, watching the horizon, spears in hand. Though they were few, they were the men he needed. You've always been one of the few, James. Keep watching the horizon.
Chills shot over Reese's body. She looked into Reese's eyes, and for a second, he knew that she was there. And that she understood.
I love you, Mama,
Reese said as he kissed her on the forehead and headed for the door, tears in his eyes. Chapter 39 Oak Tree Gun Club, Newhall, California. Pull! Horn shouted, raising his over-under shotgun and tracking the rapidly moving targets. As he fired, a pair of bright orange clay discs exploded in quick succession over the green shrubs in front of his barrel. He broke the gun open, allowing the spent shells to eject onto the shooting position's elevated wooden deck.
Well done, Steve.
A slightly annoyed Josh Holder commented as he moved forward to take his shooting position. This was his first time on the course, and he was visibly impressed by the first-class operation. The Oak Tree's owner had made more money in tech than he would be able to spend in one lifetime and didn't seem to mind that his gun club didn't make any money. For him, the real value was in knowing how uncomfortable its existence made the Los Angeles liberals. Horn was shooting a Krieghoff K80 Crown Grade Sporting Model 12-gauge shotgun. He had purchased it at one of the special operations fundraisers he had attended with Tedesco and Admiral Pilsner. It had cost more than the average American's car and had come at an even steeper price because some other asshole had tried to outbid him on it. The glossy stock of Turkish walnut, the Germanic deep relief engraving, and the precision fit and finish of the world-class competition shotgun were lost on Horn. All he knew was that it was the type of gun that others would envy. The bidding package even included a trip to Germany to tour the factory and have dinner with Dieter Krieghoff himself, though Horn never made the journey. He did take the tax write-off for supporting the charity, of course. His assistant booked him two lessons a week with the best shotgun instructor in Southern California, who trained Horn until he could outshoot nearly anyone with whom he might walk a sporting clays course. Never won for a fair fight, he always made sure to shoot with partners who couldn't match his skill level. Holder was one of the few people who intimidated Horn, and he wanted this meeting in his comfort zone, not Josh's. Pull, Josh Holder ordered, swinging his rented Remington 1100 toward the crossing pair, clipping the first target and missing the second. Sporting clays was not his game.
You have to swing through both clays, Josh. These aren't rifles.
Thanks for the tip, Horn,
Holder said without the requisite enthusiasm. Agnon recorded both men's scores as they walked to the golf cart that would carry them to the next station.
What are we going to do about Reese?
Holder cut to the point of their outing.
Well, Josh, you're... Wannabe jihadi asset couldn't manage to kill him even when guided in with a drone to his exact location. That would have been perfect. It would have looked like some crazy ISIS type had been radicalized online and was trying to get laid by his 75 virgins.
72, sir,
Saul Agnon said, speaking up from the back seat for the first time since leaving the gun club's pro shop.
What was that, Saul?
Asked Horn without turning his head to look at his lieutenant.
I believe it's 72 virgins.
Whatever, Horn continued. The bottom line is that was our best shot at him without raising too many red flags. The evidence would have pointed to some crazy lone wolf terrorist who had seen Reese in the paper with the coverage of the Afghanistan debacle and then from the additional coverage of his family's funerals. And decided to martyr himself for the cause. Case closed.
First off, that was the Hartley's classified asset,
Holder corrected.
It still boggles my mind that you even know about it. Secondly, I just ran the agent, gave him the instructions. I didn't train him up.
It's still your fuck-up, Josh. Don't worry, the Hartleys don't blame you, but they are done helping. We need you to handle this.
Let me remind you that you guys were supposed to take him out overseas. I've more than pulled my weight on this.
You're the right man for the job, Josh.
I work for JD, not you.
What do you want?
I want points on this thing.
Fine. We can't afford to dilute this thing much further, but you can have a piece.
I want 10%.
Horseshit. I'll give you 2. 2% of this is enough to set up your unborn grandkids.
5% or Reese is your problem.
Horn stared ahead silently as he steered the cart. 5 it is, but you get jack shit unless you take him out.
Fine. Any preference on how I do it?
Can't you just suicide him like you did his little buddy, you know? Make it look like he is so distraught by what happened in Afghanistan and to his family that he just couldn't take it and decided to eat a bullet. No one would question that. How many veterans kill themselves every day anyway?
Sir, estimates run from 1.5 to 22,
Agnan offered. That was rhetorical, Saul. Stop interrupting.
Yes, sir. That's easier said than done, Horn. Reese is on alert now. He knows he's being hunted. He's probably using prepaid phones, and I'd be surprised if he goes home again. Without DOD's drone assets and access to national intelligence databases, it will be tougher to find him. Not impossible, just tougher.
If he drove a newer car, we could just hack its GPS system, get his location, and send my contractors to kill him. He'd be no match for the 15 battle-hardened mercenaries we pulled back from overseas to handle this. Too bad he drives that ancient piece of shit Land Cruiser.
Horn, do not send those Neanderthals to kill him. They are tied to you and the Hartleys through your military contracts. Plus, they are the hammer. We need a scalpel.
Can you get it done or not?
I said I'd get it done, Horn. I just need to find him again. We might not be able to track his old truck, but we can find his reporter friend's car.
Good. I will consider this in your hands now. Horn stopped the cart behind the pro shop and stepped out. Let me know when you finish it. I need to get back to L.A. Enjoy the rest of the course.
You need the practice.
You drive. I need to make a call, Horn said as they approached his Aston Martin Vanquish S. Its silver color, cleverly called Skyfall by the marketers at the British car company. Horn couldn't bring himself to buy a Tesla, the car that most of his competitors in the California finance world seemed to prefer, chalking up their concern for the environment to a moral vanity he simply could not stand. No matter how fast, an electric car could never muster up the mixed feelings of admiration and jealousy that his 12-cylinder Aston Martin did when he dropped it with a valet. After ensuring that Agnan had carefully slid the Krieghoff into its leather case and set it in the back seat, Horn lowered himself into the passenger side and pulled out his phone. He disconnected it from the car's Bluetooth and stared impatiently at the screen, though he knew that the canyon surrounding Oak Tree blocked all cell service. Saul cautiously maneuvered the sports car down toward the freeway, expecting every turn to draw criticism. Once back in cell range, Horn made a call.
It's Horn. I need you to get creative on dealing with James Reese.
Without waiting for an answer, Horn terminated the connection.
Who is that?
Agnan asked his boss.
That's Saul. Was the final option. Now keep your eyes on the road and let me get some work done.
Agnan did as he was told.
Chapter 40 Wyoming Backcountry. The biggest adjustment for Reese when it came to targeting individuals on his own personal crusade was the lack of intelligence support. Overseas, an entire contingent of support personnel, not to mention the massive U.S. intelligence apparatus, was on hand to help guys like Reese find, fix, finish, and exploit the enemy. On this mission, Not only did Reese lack that support, but he had to do it all without creating a trail of evidence. It wasn't that he was afraid of getting arrested, since no punishment from the state could match what he'd already endured. He had to elude the law and postpone the death he knew was coming. It just couldn't happen until his mission was complete. The longer Reese could keep the other side and the law in the dark, the better. Knowing that he was already dead from a tumor growing in his brain was nothing short of liberating. His sole focus was on bringing justice to those who had taken everything from him. He felt no restraint, no moral conflict. He was clear in his purpose and vision. Understanding the violence he was about to bring to those who had killed his wife, daughter, unborn son, and teammates gave him an odd sense of peace. Reese had set aside a week for surveillance, only to discover that his target readily broadcast his every movement to the world via social media. It was as if he were saying, "Here I am, come and kill me." Having lived low profile for his entire professional life, this mindset was baffling to Reese. Boykin's movements were routine and predictable, and the terrain and timing were ideal for what Reese had envisioned back in Coronado. He hadn't been in the mountains since the op went bad in Afghanistan, but hiking the Wyoming backcountry with nothing but lightweight clothes and a small pack in the daylight felt a lot different than patrolling hostile territory in total darkness, burdened with the heavy tools of war. He assumed that he'd see a few hunters scouting this close to the season opener, but he never came across another soul as he followed the ridgeline that paralleled the highway. He actually walked right past the area that he eventually chose, only spotting it as he glassed back toward the country he'd just crossed. The U-shaped notch in the mountainside offered an unobstructed view down the length of the highway without being exposed in any direction other than from above. The only thing above him today were clear blue skies, so the chances of being spotted by anything but a helicopter were slim. Reese took out a small notebook and his laser rangefinder, making a careful sketch of the area and noting the range to various terrain features. As cars and trucks made their way up the northbound road, he envisioned the timing of taking a shot at each. The best spot seemed to be a dip in the road 625 yards away, and the configuration of the road and elevation matched his accident theory. It was as close to perfect as he could hope for. He marked the site on both his map and GPS and headed out in search of the most direct path back to his vehicle. With 2 days to kill, Reese spent some time exploring the area. Parked in front of the Soda Springs, Idaho Public Library, he turned on his second-hand iPhone and checked in with the world via the free Wi-Fi. He had a message on Signal from Katie's alias.
"It's me. I made it safely to my brothers. You saved my life. Be safe."
He prayed that Katie would be careful. He couldn't stand the thought of her getting hurt or killed trying to help him. No time to focus on that now. He then logged into Spider Oak, ensuring his VPN was engaged, and opened the folder he shared with Ben Edwards.
"Hey, bro. Got some info on the gangbangers. Meet you at your new home when you get back."
Even though it was supposedly secure, Reese and Ben still kept their comms as innocuous as possible. He didn't have a way to make a secure voice call to Ben without the potential of leading someone to his location. It would be obvious to anyone at that point that he was after Boykin, so the information on the gangbangers would have to wait. He drove back east to the spot he'd picked to camp. Just another guy in a truck getting away from town to spend time in the outdoors, and spent the next 24 hours going over the maps and imagery and readying his gear for his patrol to the hide site. The night before his planned hit, he built a small fire. There was something primal about fires. Since the early Stone Age, fires had quite literally sustained human life. They offered warmth and allowed the heat treating of hardwoods and eventually metals, turning them into weapons for hunting and war. They permitted cooking and early pottery, were natural gathering places, could signal, and were almost always a part of ceremonial tradition. Fires were sacred, but more than anything else, fires offered hope. Reese pondered the paradox. There was no hope for Marcus Boykin, just as there was no hope for James Reese. Staring into the burning embers of the small campfire, Reese started to remember. It had been just before his last deployment. He had taken Lauren and Lucy on a pre-deployment camping trip to Big Sur. Nestled into the Northern California coast, just south of Carmel, was a stretch of land that Reese considered to be one of the most beautiful on Earth, the sea and the mountains, Reese's favorites. Lauren had retired for the night into the tent, leaving Reese and Lucy to connect by the fire, knowing that 6 long months of separation lay ahead. Years before, Lauren had confided to Reese that every time he left the house, whether to deploy or train, she knew that he might never be coming back. She had accepted his chosen profession and would not be the kind of wife and mother who was always worried about her husband. She was immensely proud of what he did, but she had a daughter to raise, and she wasn't about to let that child see her in a constant state of worry. When Reese left, they would get on with their lives, exploring, learning, and growing. In hindsight, she must have also been tired, from supporting the life that grew inside her. Reese assumed that she had wrestled with whether to tell him and had decided to let it be a surprise when he returned. Lauren had always loved surprises, and there were so few joyful ones left in life. This was a gift she could give to him. He also knew that she would want him focused on the job overseas, not distracted thinking about his pregnant wife. That was something she could give the families of the men under Reese's command. They needed Reese focused on the task of leading SEALs into combat. To do it right would require his full measure of devotion. Reese had watched his daughter inch the marshmallow, skewered on the end of a straightened wire hanger closer to the fire. "Wait a little bit longer, sweetie," Reese had cautioned. "Wait for the embers so you can get it a nice golden brown." Lucy just smiled and moved it closer and closer to the fire until it burst into flames and she burst into giggles as Reese leaned forward and blew out what was now a charred mess. They had hiked into a desolate stretch of shoreline to avoid the more populated areas of Big Sur State Park and set up camp on the beach. In a state that had laws governing almost all aspects of daily life, it was surprising and refreshing to be allowed to still enjoy driftwood fires along the coast. Reese and Lucy were bundled up, cuddled together against the crisp cold of the Pacific twilight, in a lightweight backpacker's chair behind the fire, and looking out over the rocky shore, the waves, and the distant horizon. Reese would remember that sunset every day while overseas, would remember holding his little angel, wrapped in a poncho and lightweight blanket, listening to the cadence of the surf as the sky transitioned into night, constellation after constellation breaking through the darkness, much to Lucy's wonderment.
"What's that bright one?"
she had asked, pointing skyward. Though not an astronomer by any stretch of the imagination, Reese had a rudimentary knowledge of the constellations. It was the byproduct of a life spent outdoors. He smiled, remembering when he asked his father the same question all those years ago, under the same night sky. "That's Orion. See those stars there?" Reese asked, pointing skyward. "That's Orion's belt. Makes him easy to spot up there, doesn't it?" Lucy nodded in agreement. "If you look hard enough, you can see his shield and club. He was a hunter."
"How'd he get up there?"
asked a quizzical Lucy.
"Well, if I remember correctly," Reese continued, struggling to recall his mythology, "he was stung by a scorpion, which now occupies a spot on the other side of the sky, so they never see each other."
"That's weird," Lucy commented. "Were they friends?"
"Not exactly," Reese replied, hoping she didn't ask too many more specific questions as to what had led Orion and the Scorpion to their ultimate positions in the cosmos. Thankfully, she switched topics to one Reese knew was coming.
"Daddy, why do you have to go away on a big trip?"
Reese and Lauren had called shorter training trips little trips and referred to the upcoming deployment as a big trip.
easier for a young mind to grasp and come to terms with.
Well, sometimes daddies have to go away on big trips.
In their circle of friends, daddies were always leaving on big trips. Reese felt lucky that Lucy didn't quite realize sometimes those daddies didn't come home.
This is my last big trip, sweetheart. Then I'm not going away again. I'm going to stay home with you and Mommy. I can't wait.
I can't wait either, Dada,
she said, as much to herself as to him.
You go away because of the bad people?
Reese paused. He and Lauren had shielded her as much as possible from some of the harsher realities of growing up as a military child in a country on constant war footing. This was her time to be innocent. Obviously, she'd picked up more than they thought.
Sometimes daddies need to fight the bad guys far away, so we don't have to do it here, in our country. We do it to keep us free. You and your mom are a big part of it. The three of us are a team. We all make sacrifices to keep our country free.
When I grow up, I want to fight bad guys, too.
Reese swallowed, a lump rising in his throat.
My hope is you won't have to, sweetheart. I love you, Angel.
I love you, too, Daddy.
She nestled her head into her father's shoulder and cuddled up against him. Reese would not have wanted to be any place else on Earth right then. It was that memory to which he would return throughout deployment. When he was back from a mission, dirty and tired, just before lying down to rest, he would return to that beach, to the waves, the fire, the marshmallows, and Orion. It was to that memory he returned now, hoping nothing more than for one more chance to hold his daughter safely in his arms, rocking her to sleep on a distant beach. To him, that was heaven.
See you soon, baby girl,
he whispered into the dying embers of the fire as he drifted off to sleep. Chapter 41. The sheriff of Lincoln County, Wyoming, arrived on the scene an hour after the call went out. His office was down in Afton, and the crashed Mercedes SUV was at the extreme north end of his jurisdiction. Two highway patrolmen, two of his deputies, and a state game and fish officer were on site along with the detective from his office. An ambulance had pulled in, but the paramedic and driver were still inside, since there was not much they could do for the man in the silver Mercedes. One of the trooper's cars was parked to block a lane of the highway as he stood in the road to direct the occasional driver around what had become a crime scene. A tow truck driver stood staring down at the shredded vehicle, obviously trying to figure out how he was going to remove it from the steep ditch. The sheriff approached the gaggle of law enforcement officers gathered on the road shoulder above the vehicle.
"All right, what do we have?"
he asked, glancing at his watch before peering down the ravine. The detective spoke up.
"Sheriff, as you know, the highway patrol discovered this vehicle just after 9 a.m. this morning. They saw the skid marks on the highway and pulled over to investigate. EMS arrived and discovered what appears to be a bullet wound at the center of the driver's face and an exit wound at the back of his skull. Based on the trauma to his head, I'd say it was a rifle round, maybe a .30 caliber or so, just looking at the entry."
The detective motioned toward the fresh black marks on the roadway.
"Our theory at this point is that the driver gets shot while heading this way, and the speed and abrupt turn of the wheel caused the vehicle to flip over and down the embankment."
"That certainly makes sense. Except the part about the 06 round to the face. Who shot this guy and why?"
"It's opening day for deer in this unit, Sheriff,"
the game and fish officer offered.
"Some guy with a tag in his pocket, probably an out-of-stater, takes a shot at his skyline buck from the road. It's illegal, but we know it happens. He misses, shoots over the top of the deer, and the bullet's trajectory takes it over this rise. Gravity drops the bullet down into that dip in the road, just as this poor bastard is coming the other way. I'd say this guy's number was up."
"I'll buy it. I've seen stranger things. Who is he?"
The detective answered. "DL says he's Marcus Boykin. He's driving on a New York license, but we have a listing for a Marcus Boykin at Star Valley Ranch. Typical summer resident." Satisfied that his men were conducting a thorough and proper investigation, the sheriff nodded and turned back toward his government-supplied Ford Expedition.
He was the featured speaker at a Chamber of Commerce lunch at noon, and he didn't intend to be late. Chapter 42. Bird Rock, California. Invigorated by the shot of adrenaline the morning's success had brought, Reese drove straight through to Southern California, stopping only for food and fuel at hole-in-the-wall gas stations, all paid for in cash. He arrived at Ben's place at midnight, backing down the driveway and into the garage where he unloaded his gear. Even at night, he could tell it was a beautiful place, a contemporary condo in the trendy Bird Rock neighborhood of San Diego, nestled between La Jolla and Pacific Beach. The design was open, incorporating light natural woods with industrial steel finishes. Huge floor-to-ceiling windows led seamlessly to a deck that overlooked the dark ocean. Even though it was a few houses back from the cliffs, Reese could still hear the surf breaking on the rocks below. He took a shower and checked his Spider Oak folder, sending Edwards a message that said only, "At your place, bring breakfast," before hitting the sack. 7 hours later, he heard someone pounding on the door and realized that he'd slept like a rock. He grabbed the Glock from his bedside table and looked through the crack in the bedroom blinds to find Ben's rental car parked below him in the driveway. Still half asleep, he tossed his handgun onto the bed and opened the back door wearing boxers and a t-shirt. "Holy shit, did I wake you up? I can come back at noon if you want. You think you're back in college, frat boy? You need a haircut and a shave. You're starting to look like the bad guys. I brought your favorite, Night and Day Cafe." Reese gave Ben the one-finger salute as he walked into the condo's small kitchen to make coffee while Ben unpacked the short order to-go food on the counter. Taking a huge bite of his breakfast burrito, Reese gestured to the surrounding condo with its sweeping view of the Pacific. "Nice place." "Yeah, my employer has a few of these scattered across the country. We use them for debriefings and meets that require an off-site due to sensitivity issues. This one is pretty nice and hardly ever gets used." "Our tax dollars at work, huh? This place must have cost you hundreds." "Good old Uncle Sugar," Ben said and smiled. He finished his breakfast and packed a dip of tobacco into his lower lip before pulling a file folder out of a nylon backpack he'd hung on the back of his chair. "All right, bro. It turns out that the shitheads who did this weren't local gangbangers. They were legit bad hombres from Mexico. DEA watches these guys very closely, as you know, and actually have them coming and going the night of the attack. I don't have specific IDs on the shooters, but we know they are Cartel Jalisco Nueva Generacion, CJNG, or New Generation, and we know where they live." Edwards slid a series of photos across the kitchen table, each depicting a different angle of the same three-story concrete block structure with caged balconies and barred windows, a cluster of satellite TV dishes mounted to the roof. "They live and work out of this house in Tijuana, typical shithole. You can expect a dozen or so equipped with small arms along with some women and even kids hanging around. Call it a gang clubhouse. These aren't high-level dudes, they're foot soldiers." Reese looked at the photos carefully, taking note of various features on the house's exterior.
"Any idea on the interior layout?"
"Negative, DEA doesn't have eyes inside."
"How about the neighborhood? How quick can they summon the cavalry if something goes down?"
"CJNG is just starting to get a foothold in Tijuana, so they're pretty exposed. This is like an outpost for them. They're trying to increase their reach into the city, and they're running it from this place. Kind of like when we'd set up a combat outpost during a clear hold build. The Tijuana and Sinaloa cartels don't want them there, so it's a fight. I wouldn't want to hang around that neighborhood very long, but it's not like they have 100 reinforcements across the street."
"Check. Where is this place in the city?"
"That's the challenge. It's in La Sanchez Tabuada, here." Edwards pointed to a spot on an aerial photograph of the city. "Real bad neighborhood. It would be tough to get on target without some local help. It would be one thing to roll up with a couple of Strikers or Bradleys, but I wouldn't want to be wandering around there solo at 3 a.m. looking for a place to park. You want me to find you some help? I bet the Sinaloa guys would be happy to assist you in taking out their competition."
"Negative. This is my show. I'll handle it. Besides, the last thing I need is to roll into a gunfight in a third world slum with a bunch of criminals I can't trust.
Gotcha. Let me know if I can support with anything else. This stuff is all yours to keep. The best intel we have is in there. If you change your mind about having help, let me know. You know I'll roll down there with you if you need me.
Thanks, Ben. You've helped more than you know. I don't need you getting more involved in this than you already have.
Happy to help. I'm headed out. Gotta go to work, trying to poach some talent from Team 5. Be safe.
Thanks, buddy. You too.
Reese spent the next few hours looking at the target info on the house in Tijuana. As much as he wanted to exact immediate vengeance on the monsters who murdered his wife and daughter, he knew that now was not the time to act on emotion. If he was going to come out of Mexico alive, it would take some planning to pull off. He also assumed that they were most likely hired guns, and if he was going to figure out who hired them and why, he was going to have to stick to his plan. He had one shot at pulling off the next phase of the operation before his current intel went stale. According to email traffic between Josh Holder and Saul Agnan, Agnan would be at a resort in Palm Springs for a conference in 2 days. Agnan, who appeared to be the hub of this conspiratorial wheel, was Reese's best chance to put the pieces of this puzzle together. Hard lessons learned in Iraq and Afghanistan had taught Reese that going after the head of the snake could be counterproductive. Killing or capturing a senior al-Qaeda leader always led to another one taking his place, now smarter, having learned from his senior's mistakes. After some amount of studying and bringing in civilian anthropologists and counterinsurgency experts from academia, some commanders began to use cross-cut targeting as a way to more effectively take out the heir apparent before working both up and down the enemy chain of command across multiple networks. Reese understood the methodology. Agnan was his version of cross-cut targeting. Reese was not going to allow this network to evolve. He was going to destroy it. He was going to kill them all.
Chapter 43. Palm Springs, California. Saul Agnan wasn't the type to do much socializing. His work for Steve Horn and Capstone monopolized both his time and his energy. Though he didn't technically practice law, Agnan was proud of his attorney status, and maintaining his license required mandatory hours of continuing legal education. Each year he attended the Los Angeles Bar Association's fall retreat in Palm Springs, which not only satisfied his annual CLE requirement, but was also a much-awaited chance to interact with other attorneys. Agnan sat next to a red-headed litigator from a big L.A. firm at dinner, but despite his best efforts, couldn't convince her to join him for a nightcap in his casita. He hung around the late-night cocktail reception for a while, but by 11 o'clock p.m., he was ready for bed. He had another long day of seminars to attend the next morning, and unlike most of the attendees, he actually enjoyed the material being presented. He wasn't much of a drinker and felt a bit tipsy from the 3 glasses of Chardonnay that he'd consumed during dinner and the margarita that he'd enjoyed at the reception. He always got turned around at this resort with its winding paths and dozens of identically designed guest houses. It took him a full 10-minute walk in the clear desert night to reach his casita, and another clumsy 30 seconds to fish his room key out of his blazer pocket and get it into the electronic lock the right way before he could open the door. He closed the door behind him and was delighted to hear that the maid had turned on some classical music while performing the turndown service, though he did think it to be a bit loud. He removed his blue blazer and opened the armoire before reaching for a hanger, fumbling and dropping it on the stone floor. Damn. Bending over to retrieve it, he was suddenly pulled backward by strong arms that locked around his neck, legs scissoring around his torso while being pulled onto the floor. He was essentially lying on his back on the man's chest, being squeezed like he was in the clutches of an anaconda. He struggled to turn his head, but when he did so, the assailant's arm moved tighter around his throat. He tried to scream, but no sound escaped. With the blood supply cut off to his brain, he passed out in seconds. Saul awoke after what must have been only a few moments, naked, bound, gagged, and blindfolded. The sound of Beethoven's Fifth blasted in his ears over the sound system in his room. Even if he could scream, no one would hear him. His hands were restrained behind his back, and his feet were somehow shackled. He tried to bring himself to his knees, but was immediately shoved back down to the cold stone floor. Whoever had attacked him was still there and was watching his every move. His brain was foggy from the alcohol, but it took him only a few seconds to figure it out. James Reese had found him. The reality of what was happening hit Agnan in the form of complete, overwhelming terror. He felt the searing acid of vomit rise through his throat and retched as his dinner surged into his mouth. The cloth gag gave the sick liquid nowhere to go, backing it into his esophagus and filling his airway. Seconds after regaining consciousness from the rear naked choke, Agnan was drowning in his own vomit. The sense of panic was overwhelming. He gagged, snorted, and gagged again, all the while burning the precious oxygen for which his brain was beginning to starve. Reese saw the man convulse and watched vomit shoot from his nostrils. He began flopping around like a fish on the deck of a boat, craving oxygen and choking on his own sickness. As much as he would have liked, Reese didn't come all this way to watch the man whom Holder's emails identified as a key contributor to the killing of Reese's family and SEAL troop drown in his own puke. He reached down to remove the cloth that he'd tied around Agnan's mouth, pulling it off over his head and removing the blindfold in the process. The man continued to writhe in agony as his head turned a deep purple color, the veins in his neck standing out like cables. Reese wrenched the man's head back by his hair with one hand and stuck a gloved finger down his throat with the other to trigger the gag reflex. Vomit shot forward across the floor, and Agnan's body convulsed as it cleared itself of the fluid. The rotten stench of stomach acid, food, and alcohol was overwhelming. Even with the surgical mask over his face, Reese had to turn away to keep from gagging. Puking on the floor was not a great way to keep one's DNA out of a murder scene. An animal moan escaped from Agnan's throat, sounding like the death bellow of a large bovine. The good news was that he could breathe again. He didn't say a word as he lay naked on his side, panting for air with tears streaming down his face. What had been a normal human being 10 minutes earlier was now a quivering mess, which was exactly what Reese wanted. "Can you breathe now?" Reese asked in a voice devoid of sympathy. Saul nodded repeatedly without saying a word or even opening his eyes. Reese hoped that the guy's heart wouldn't fail. When it looked like Agnan's respiration had returned to a normal range, Reese tied the vomit-soaked rag that had served as a gag around Saul's eyes and began dragging his limp body toward the bathroom of the resort cottage. He'd already prepared the area by folding two large bath towels over the side of the tub to prevent bruising the man's back. Saul's compliance as Reese dragged him into position suggested that this process wouldn't take very long. Reese wrapped Saul's head with plastic wrap, covering his mouth but not his nose. He then pulled the attorney's body over the lip of the bathtub so that his head and shoulders were held below his waist and his feet stayed outside the tub just off the tile floor. He straddled the smaller man and grabbed him by the throat with his left hand to get the angle correct while turning on the faucet with his right. The fixture had one of those handheld shower heads on a flexible hose, which Reese now held over Agnan's face. The stream from the massaging head flooded Saul's eyes and nostrils with water, which followed gravity downward and flowed into his sinuses, mouth, and throat. The angle of his head prevented the water from entering his lungs, thus he would not actually drown, though everything in the man's brain suggested otherwise. Every fiber in Saul's body screamed for air, and it took all of Reese's strength to maintain his grip on the violently thrashing figure below him. Agnan coughed spastically to clear the water from his throat, but the plastic wrap acted as a one-way valve, letting the air from his lungs escape while keeping the water in his mouth. Though he didn't realize it, all his coughing accomplished was to speed up the process. The plastic wrap trick was something that Reese had learned from the CIA interrogators way back in the Wild West days just after 9/11, when Americans still had the will to win. Reese continued to spray water into Saul's nostrils as unimaginable sounds echoed in the confines of the bathroom. Good thing the casita was freestanding and the walls were thick. After a count of 20, Reese removed the stream of water from Agnan's face and pulled the man's body upright into a seated position on the urine-soaked bathroom floor. He pulled the plastic wrap down from Agnan's face so that it hung loosely around his neck.
"You know who I am, don't you, Saul?" Reese asked in an almost kind voice.
"I do. I do,"
gasped Saul between hyperventilating breaths.
"Then you know why I'm here."
Saul shook his head violently.
I didn't do anything. I just work for Horn.
See, you're already bullshitting me. I can't have you doing that, Saul.
Reese swiftly and violently wrenched Agnan back into the waterboarding position and resumed the spray of water. Without the plastic, it was a bit messier, but the net effect was the same. He was able to move the man from 0 to 10 on the punishment scale within a few seconds. Agnan's brain was quickly learning that doing anything other than complying meant instant and unimaginable torture. After Saul had spent another 20 seconds under the hose, Reese dragged him back out of the tub. Reese had himself been waterboarded during Seer School after an escape attempt that the instructors deemed worthy of the treatment. He knew that as bad as the process of enduring the simulated drowning was, the threat of going through it again was the real motivator, or demotivator, depending on your position.
"You ready to talk and tell me the truth?"
"Yes. Yes. I am,"
Agnan gasped. Reese stood and walked over to the bathroom counter, retrieving a small tape recorder and placing it on the closed lid of the toilet before pressing record. He then let the man catch his breath for a few moments before he started asking questions. He began with an easy one.
"Who is Josh Holder?"
"He's a DOD agent. He's a DC guy. But he's out here for this project."
"Why him? Why is DOD involved?"
"He's the Hartley's guy. He does work for them, double-dipping with DOD and J.D. Hartley's consulting firm. He was a liaison when Hartley was in Congress and has been a confidant of theirs ever since."
Reese took the conversation in a different direction.
"Tell me about RD-4895. How does this guy know so much?"
Agnan thought.
"It's an experimental drug. A big company stumbled on it a few years back and saw its potential to prevent PTSD, some sort of neuron blocker. It seemed to work, but they couldn't get the safety profile worked out. The test animals kept getting tumors. They put it on the auction block and Capstone bought it dirt cheap."
Reese looked at the nude, blindfolded form before him and knew that he'd broken him. The terror of the last few minutes combined with the looming threat of a repeat performance had taken away whatever spine Agnan had in the first place. Grabbing him by the arm, Reese hoisted Agnan to a standing position and led him back into the living area of the casita. The restraints around Agnan's ankles made the pace painfully slow. He unstrapped one side of the hospital restraints from Agnan's wrist and moved the man's arms to the front of his body. He then retied the restraints with Agnan's hands in the front and pushed him backward into a chair. Opening the door to the minibar, he removed 2 airplane-sized bottles of Jim Beam and poured both into a glass that he then placed on the small end table next to Agnan. He retrieved the tape recorder from the bathroom and put it on the table as well. Turning the classical music down, Reese removed the waterlogged and vomit-stained rag from Agnan's face and watched his eyes blink, slowly adjusting to the light. Wearing white Tyvek coveralls with a hood, a surgical mask, clear-shooting glasses, and disposable paper booties over his shoes, Reese looked more like a lab technician than a commando. Agnan knew instantly that he wasn't going to survive this night, and he resigned himself to his fate. Whatever will to fight he'd possessed had been broken down by those few oxygen-starved moments. Reese motioned to the glass of bourbon on the table. Agnan suddenly realized how thirsty he was, and reached hungrily with both manacled hands to pick up the glass. The brown liquid burned as it washed down his throat, but it helped bring a calm over his body and broken spirit.
So you were telling me about buying the drug. Why did Capstone buy it if the side effects were so bad? How did it have any value?
My boss is a risk taker. He doesn't go for the easy play, but he's also good at stacking the deck in his favor. He paid next to nothing for the compound. The United States is in a war with no end in sight, and if they could get the tumor stuff sorted out, the drug would be worth a fortune. In the meantime, the entire project was flooded with DOD funding, so the financial gamble was minimal.
What do you mean, DOD funding?
We're playing with the house's money. This whole thing is being subsidized by the DOD. For the past 2 years, there's been $100 million in the Defense Appropriations Act for PTSD research, and all of that money goes to our fund, except for the 10% we pay to Hartley.
The SecDef gets a $10 million kickback? Rees said incredulously.
Not directly. We pay her husband 10% to be our consultant. Technically, contingency lobbying is illegal, but we pay him $10 million for his services out of last year's appropriation to give everything the appearance of being above board. It's obviously a sham, but nobody's looking too hard. People think that politicians are on the take, and they're right, but it's not in the way that everyone thinks. Nobody takes bags of cash these days. If you did, you'd end up in federal prison. It's all done with undisclosed conflicts of interest. You show me a member of Congress who's part of the appropriations process, and I'll show you a wife, child, a brother-in-law with a company that benefits from federal dollars. Everybody does it. The Hartleys are just playing on a different level.
Jesus. You guys don't have your own scientists, though.
No. We contract with a lab in India. They pay pennies over there so you can hire PhDs for next to nothing. Boykin handled the science and the analytics. He's some sort of doctor-turned-accountant and financial analyst specializing in the healthcare sector. He hatched the idea, and Mr. Horn gave the lab in India a timeline and a budget to rework the compound. They thought they had it worked out.
How did it get tested on my guys?
With potential for this much money, you'd be surprised what people will do. I'm talking about tens of billions of dollars, which is a lot of money to spread around and make friends. Not to mention the tens of millions that we're getting from Congress that just gave everyone a taste. Mr. Horn put the offer out to a few of his close confidants, including Mike Tedesco. You get Tedesco, and you get the Hartleys.
You telling me that the SecDef arranged to test an experimental drug on a random SEAL troop? You bullshitting me again, Saul?
No, I wouldn't bullshit you, Mr. Rees. You know what a politician Admiral Pilsner is. He worked directly for Secretary Hartley at the Pentagon, and they became close. She has him on track to be the Chief of Naval Operations and probably Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He's totally loyal to her. Of course, he was promised an enormous sum of money as well. She let him choose who to use through Tedesco and Holder, of course.
You mean the Admiral personally chose my troop to test out this drug?
Rees asked, his eyes narrowing.
That's how it happened, Mr. Rees. I swear.
Interesting.
Rees paused before continuing.
How did you ever hope to get something like this approved? The FDA isn't going to accept results from some drug that you tested on people without their consent. I'm no expert, but I know there are all kinds of standards that have to be met. Phase 1, phase 2, all of that.
That would be true normally, but when the president names the head of the FDA and they want a drug approved during wartime to help every man and woman in uniform, no one is going to ask a lot of tough questions.
So now you're telling me that the president is involved? Is the freaking Queen of England also part of this conspiracy?
No, not this president. The next president. Secretary Hartley.
No way, Reese thought. How in the hell did I get mixed up in this shit show?
How did you get us to take it? I didn't take any pills or anything on this deployment.
Remember the tactical performance study that your team participated in?
Yeah, they took our VO2 max and ran a bunch of cognitive tests on us.
That was a cover for this. The vitamin B12 shots you were given in the second half of that study were actually RD4895. We did a baseline physical and psychological assessment. We assumed that everything was going well until the blood work came back from the last battery of tests before your troop deployed. White blood cell counts for a bunch of your men were off the charts, and there were various other abnormalities that indicated that the compound hadn't been fixed.
And that's when Boykin made the call to pull the plug and have us all killed?
I don't know. I really don't, Mr. Reese.
Saul managed to get out through his tears.
How do you know so much about Marcus?
I found out about him a few days before I put a bullet through his brain in Wyoming.
Oh, my God, this is real. He's really going to kill us all.
Though Saul said nothing, his expression betrayed it all.
How do you arrange a Taliban ambush halfway across the globe?
You guys cut Haji in on the billions?
We left it up to Pilsner on how to clean things up. All through Tedesco and Horn. They got to know each other through all those high-end fundraisers they throw for you guys, for the foundations and charities. And that stuff is big business.
So Pilsner sets us up for an ambush and gets a bunch of Rangers and Army aircrew killed for good measure. How the hell did he manage that?
I don't know. Exactly. Mr. Reese, I just know that's how it went down.
Saul took another long gulp of the bourbon. And Boozer and I survive.
Yes. So Josh Holder makes your man's death look like a suicide, leaving only you remaining.
What about Chinatown? How did you find me?
The SecDef. She allocated a UAV to track you.
What? She diverted a national drone asset to help kill me?
I swear it's true, Mr. Reese. I swear.
Who is Humza Kamir?
Who?
Humza Kamir, the man you sent to kill me in Chinatown.
I didn't even know his name until you just mentioned it. That's the SecDef's asset. I have no idea. Somebody they radicalize online in case they need some dirty work done that can be attributed to Islam.
Reese shook his head in disbelief.
Could that possibly be true?
Say that again. They do what?
They have this program where they radicalize at-risk individuals from target populations. They recruit them to what they think is a radical Islamic movement and then use them as expendable assets. I know it sounds crazy, but it's true. I swear.
Reese paused as the gravity of what Agnan had just told him sank in.
Are you certain?
Reese asked, his voice icy and pointed.
I couldn't believe it either when I first found out about it. In fact, I'm not even supposed to know about it. I wish I didn't. I think the Hartleys might have created it. I don't know. I just know it exists.
Where do the Mexicans fit into all of this?
They were just contract labor. This isn't the movies where you hire a hitman to kill someone. We pay some of the cops to make the arrangements with gang types to do it. Mr. Reese,
Reese cut him off. Don't fucking do it. Don't even sit there and apologize for having my pregnant wife and baby girl shot down in our home by some fucking drug cartel. Trust me when I tell you that you don't want to do that. Agnan sat silently staring at the floor in front of Reese. If this doesn't work, Reese asked, resuming his interrogation, how are you planning to make money on it? You got to be throwing some serious numbers at all these collaborators to get them to risk everything. How are they going to get paid if the drug is no good?
Well, now the drug works. There are no efficacy issues, at least not on the latest test rats in India. It's proving to be over 20% more effective than placebo. As for the adverse events, the tumors, we are confident that we have addressed that in the latest version of the product.
The most recent test population has shown no such signs.
You mean to tell me that you've tried this thing on another group of unwilling people? More seals?
Yes, Admiral Pilsner arranged for another group of candidates, and they are doing just fine.
You bastards! Reese shot.